This week on Retronauts, dream yourself a digital dream come true. Hello, and welcome to Retronauts. I am your host, the perpetually sleepy Nadia Oxford. My guest for this week is some weird rando who sleeps beside me on most nights, David Oxford. How are you, David?
Hey, I'm doing all right. Just finished up a bit of a project earlier.
Yes, it's a very exciting project. I don't know if you can talk about it. I guess you can, huh?
I can mention that it exists for anyone who missed it. At San Diego Comic-Con, Udon Entertainment announced that Mega Man Legends is getting a miniseries, a comic miniseries.
Well, gosh
darn.
That's
about the extent I can say of it. Well, that, McFong is on art again, and I'm writing again. And that's about the extent I can say of it.
That's actually why we're recording this this episode appropriately a little late at night, because, you were working on that, and I was, helping you a bit, but... We have fun in this house. What can I say? This week's topic, speaking of fun, is about dreamscapes in video games, specifically the ones that stand out to us, the ones that haunt our dreams, if you will. Dreams are probably the most fascinating byproduct of the human mind. That we spend so much time wandering around in them, and yet we understand so little about them. Some people dream vividly. Some people believe they don't dream at all, even though that's not true. Literally everybody dreams. Even animals dream. We've all seen our little kitty cats and dogs chase little things in their dreams and kill in their dreams and murder in their dreams. It's very sweet and touching. Much has been written about dreams, especially with people like Freud and Jung, but researchers' best guess, like why we dream, like why it happens, their best guess is we are doing basically a mind defrag in that our brain absorbs all this stuff during the day and then says, like, okay, I need to sort this all out when we're asleep. That's a defrag. It kind of goes, like, it puts everything together, pieces it all together. David, do you think kids know what a defrag is anymore?
Maybe in a very niche way, like the kind, like, I don't know, do computer nerds still exist?
Hard to say. You don't really find kids who are computer nerds anymore. The algorithms and the closed gardens have decided what they are interested in terms of hardware and software.
Yeah.
So, that's a bit of a bummer. But, I think defrag, it almost sounds like one of those things like Gen Z would adopt, or not Gen Z, even Gen Alpha would adopt, like, you know, ironically, oh man, I got a defrag right now, which they have to go to the bathroom.
You mean like when they see a floppy disk and they're like, oh, it's a 3D printed version of the save icon.
I still think that's crap. I still think that's not true. They can't be doing that. Or I'm just coping, but, you know, whatever. Even if we like sort out all of dreaming's mysteries, it probably won't lessen its impact as a tool of inspiration for the creative and spiritual side of humanity. Dreams are the hotline to our destiny for it's always been that way for heroes, for weirdos, and for prophets. That's what makes them great, great, great settings for video games. Especially because, as it turns out, quote, "It Was All a Dream" is a perfect cover for weird events and gameplay mechanics, but if you try to write "It Was All a Dream" at the end of your story, your teacher will yell at you. Take it from someone who knows. So let's talk about a selection of our favorite video game dreamscapes while we're still awake, because it's kind of late right now, as I said. Obviously, we can't name them all, and obviously, as something as widespread as dreaming, we can't mention every single game that has been inspired by dreams. We will fall asleep long before that can happen. So let's take a selection between the two of us, and just kind of talk about what we got here, because we got quite a bit. Even with the selection we have, there's a lot to go over, so... Let's go to sleep. Let's let our heads hit the pillow and begin. Well, first of all, let's talk a little bit about the dreams that we dream. I myself am a very vivid/lucid dreamer. I don't know if you remember this, David, but like I am someone who dreams about like other worlds and cool things all the time and frightening things and liminal things. But there was one time I punched you in the face when we were asleep. And it's because I was having a dream about looking for paper towels and like I was reaching out for a paper towel on the shelf and I punched you in the face. Do you remember that?
Oh, gee, no, I have no recollection of that. I wonder why that would be. Oh, maybe something hit me in the head.
I think it was more like I hit your phone and because you're reading in bed and it dropped in your face. That was pretty funny.
Yeah, so it was something like that. Yeah, I definitely remember that. Yeah.
What about you? Like, I think we've talked about it. I'm sure we have. But like, what kind of dreams do you typically have? Like, do you remember them? Do you?
I have garbage dreams. There'd be like lucid dreams and things would make sense and I would remember them. Sometimes I could even like, you know, become aware I was in a dream and kind of like, you know, take some sense of control. I don't know what the hell happened since then because now it's just like garbage in, garbage out. I barely remember anything. What I do remember barely makes any sense in any kind of context that I can't even like write down what I had dreams about. It's just, man, yeah, what was that about defragging?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, the nature of your dreams just changed as you got older. I mean, they say that that kind of thing happens. That's why kids have a lot more nightmares than adults is because their minds are still developing, kind of hasn't really settled in yet in terms of, you know, how it works, how it thinks. I guess maybe the same happened to you.
Maybe. Like, weirdly, the most recurring things, like, that I can remember in dreams, like, I'll often end up in some sort of, like, sometimes it'll be, like, a grocery store or, like, you know, I'll be back in school and it'll be, like, the last day of school and we're just, like, you know, cleaning out lockers or, like, waiting for people to pick us up or something. Or sometimes I might be, like, in a really big hotel or something, but...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, beyond that, it's like just kind of a total, like, I have no freaking idea. So sometimes they kind of like, I don't know. I won't know if I'd say they'd bleed into each other, but maybe you'd see like more like, I don't know, retail in a school than normal. Although, you know, around some of the colleges here, that's not necessarily untrue, but.
there's a I don't know if the word, is it litmus test is the word that I would use, but there's a test that kind of goes around that kind of says a little bit about your personality. Because it's a common dream that people have and how you react to it says a little bit about you. Do you ever dream that you or we are in an apartment somewhere, not necessarily our apartment, but it could be, and you find a door that you hadn't seen before, even it could be big, could be small, whatever, but you've noticed it for the first time and you go in and you just find a whole bunch, just like a big room, a whole bunch of space, like an unexplored space that just kind of goes on and it's big and yawning. How does that make you feel if you would find it in your dream? Do you remember?
Yes and no. I've had something like that where it wasn't in like our apartment, but like where we were in some sort of house, like maybe we got a house or something. And I would find like, you know, a door that's just like, you know, like a passageway to like all this other space and stuff. And I mean, honestly, I found it pretty exciting. I mean, like, God, if I like had my own house, I would want like hidden rooms and stuff.
Yeah.
Just to kind of, you know, for various purposes.
Yeah, I kind of had the same reaction. And what it says about you apparently is that you are good at adapting to things on the fly and you don't stress out that easily, which I would argue otherwise. But yeah, it's actually one of my favorite kinds of dreams where I've had a dream where like, you know, in our bedroom.
Wait. Sorry, are you arguing otherwise on your side or on my side?
Oh, I don't know.
Which one of us are you saying gets like stressed out more easily?
That's a good question. I think we both get equally stressed out on different days. Yeah, but I've had dreams where like, you know, there's like a tiny door in a closet, our closet specifically, and I go in it and there's just a huge room beyond it. And I'm like, oh, this is so cool. We have room.
Yeah. That's part of my thought. It's like exciting. It's like getting to explore something and knowing that it like it's mine and it's like, I could do something with this. Like, you know,
yeah,
it feels like an opportunity.
Well, there's a little bit of psychology for you before we get into all this. Here's a little another quick fun fact. I'm in my 40s, as are you. You never stop dreaming about school. You never stop dreaming about that exam that you are like supposed to take, even though you have never attended this class. What might change from person to person is what the subject is that you always beef up. For me, the subject is always something like gym. It's always gym. Who fails gym? How do you fail gym?
I don't think I've ever had, or at the very least, if I have, it's been really rare that like I'm actually like in class or taking an exam. It's usually more like after school kind of stuff, just, you know, kind of hanging out or walking around the place or whatever.
That's pretty cool. Like Persona. Heartbreak, heartbreak. That's one for the RPG fans, I suppose. Okay. Yeah, so I guess a final question I have about the psychology of it all is, obviously, you're both creative people of a sort. Are you inspired by your dreams? Like, I know you keep a dream journal, and you do say you don't remember your dreams, but I think you remember more than you think you do. So do you ever find yourself inspired in any way, shape, or form by your dreams?
Maybe sometimes, if I can remember something that, like, you know, might possibly be worthwhile, but it's few and far between.
Yeah. I guess it doesn't help that dreamscapes tend to be kind of like gelatinous, for lack of a better term, unlike the ones in games, which we are going to discuss today, barring one really interesting exception that I learned about when I was researching this.
Yeah. But like I said, for me, it's like garbage in, garbage out. So if I find something like sifting through it that, like, you know, might work, like, you know, devoid of all the other context of whatever the dream was, maybe, but yeah, no, not often.
I find it tend to I borrow vibes from dreams more than anything. I also find that this is very interesting. My dreams changed, like, the, I don't know if how you describe, like, the flavor or scent or shade of your dreams. I don't know how, there's no way to really quantify it because it's not really quantifiable, but with the introduction of AI imagery, something about seeing that screwed up my dreams permanently and changed that particular shade, that particular flavor, that particular scent of my dreams permanently. And it's just so odd that that happened. And I'm not saying it was, I mean, God, I hate AI, obviously, you know, the generative AI that's destroying us all. But the fact that it changed my dreams at all, I find that very interesting. But that's just all psychology. I have had like 3 sleep tests. I have sleep apnea. I kind of fall asleep on the fly. I don't really have narcolepsy or anything like that, but I do hallucinate very easily. I lapse into micro dreams very easily. So yeah, I get a lot of inspiration from the weird places I go in my mind. And I am not alone, if video games are any indication. So let's get into that before we fall asleep. So first off, and I'm sure that you want to discuss this first and foremost, David, it is the game, the big game. We are starting with games that take place in dreams, that is, like, games that mostly or entirely take place in a dream or are a dream sequence. And of course, we have Super Mario Brothers 2, Did You Know, Doki Doki Panic, etc., etc. David, you love this game. So,
oh, yes.
Let's talk. I'll just start off with a point that I find very interesting. This is the game that taught me what subconscious means in the word subcon, the name of the kingdom. Did you know the word subconscious before you played Super Mario 2, David?
I am thinking that was a long time ago. I think I did, but I think where I kind of got hung up was I would not pick up on, like, you know, like wordplay and stuff as much easily back then. Cause,
right, of course.
I don't know. It felt, I guess maybe, I don't know if it went over my head or I just felt like it was low hanging fruit. Cause it's like, you know,
you're too, like, good back, for puns as an 8-year old.
Yeah, back then, it's like I thought everything was like originals. So, like, you know, the idea of something like, say, Ninja Turtles being derivative of, like, you know, Daredevil and X-Men and whatnot. Mm. Like, you know, the thought of that, or like April O'Neil's outfit being inspired by like Bruce Lee and stuff like that. Like, inspiration, I don't know, it almost felt like blasphemy to me because I imagined these things were like such original ideas and such creative that I did not tend to peer, like, you know, beneath the surface. So, yeah, subcon, I think it's just like, you know, I just, you know, read it as subcon and I didn't think much more about it than that, like, you know, for subconscious. Like, you know, I don't think I connected the dots.
I think I didn't connect the dots initially because, like you, I didn't think it was subconscious. But I think what made me realize was back then, you know, around that time, when newspapers had those big, fat, giant comics, like on Sundays, you'd have like pages and pages of comics. You remember that? Mm-hmm. In the newspaper? That's when I would read, like, my parents would get the Toronto Sun, which was written in jumbo green crayon. And that had a really great comic section on Sundays, to be honest. And it had, remember You Can with Beekman? And that's where I learned the word subconscious, because someone asked about dreams and he mentioned the word, oh, dreams, blah, 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 subconscious. I'm like, wait a minute. Subconscious. And my mind was blown. I was a very smart little child. I wasn't.
I don't remember when the dots were connected for me, but then it was just kind of like, oh, okay, yeah, I guess.
you didn't have the same blow up as I did, like, wow, I'm so smart.
Nah. If anything, I probably felt stupider for not seeing it sooner.
Well, in the case of Mario Brothers 2, of course, blah, 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 Doki Doki Panic, as we all know, the game was adapted from Doki Doki Panic because mm-hmm. of many, many reasons. But the thing that, of course, when we played Mario 2, you probably had a way of knowing that, maybe because you were like one of those nerds who had all the supplementary media and stuff like that. I usually couldn't afford the games themselves even, so I didn't have anything to really tell me. You are playing a Mario game, and the reason it looks so freaking weird is because it used to be a licensed game for Nippon TV. So when I thought about it, or when I think about it in the context of how I enjoyed Mario 2 as a kid, I think, okay, well, Shy Guys are weird. Everything's weird. Like, all the rules are reversed. You jump on an enemy. It doesn't die. Like, you don't really see the familiar sights like the Koopa shells and whatnot, except like in, you know, very specific contexts. Oh, it is kind of like a dream, isn't it? It's kind of like there's a lot that's familiar, but also very warped.
The context, like as far as Doki Doki Panic goes, didn't find out about that one for about 3 years. And I could pretty much pinpoint where and when, if I'm not mistaken, which mm-hmm. was like, you know, a little footnote in the Mario Mania Player's Guide.
Right, which you had.
Mm-hmm. That's when I found out about, like, you know, the lost levels and that there was a different Mario 2 in Japan and all that fun. But, yeah, Super Mario Brothers 2, that was, like, the first big release, like, after I became a Nintendo fan. Like, it was mm-hmm. almost, like, concurrent. Yeah, I mean, I've still got the box. I still have the manual. I believe
you
they're
do.
Basically right behind you as we speak. Look out!
It's coming for you. I actually think that's really funny because, yes, you do have the manual, and yes, you do have the box, and yes, they're all very neatly put together, and yes, you carried that with you to Canada, and I just vividly remember you going through my collection, as it were, and seeing.
Oh, no. Is this about your Mario 3 manual?
The Mario 3 manual where, like, Bowser and Roy Koopa saying, Mario sure has some neat tricks, I hope we can stop him, and either my brother and I took a crayon and wrote, oh shit, coming out of his mouth because we were very funny.
A red crayon, if I remember correctly.
A red crayon. And of course, the rest of the like stuff that I had was like scribbled on or, you know, I cut up the boxes. I infamously cut up my Final Fantasy VI box, sorry, Final Fantasy III box for a school project. That was one of my biggest regrets in life. Yeah.
My Super Mario Brothers 2 box is probably the worst shape of any of the boxes I have. Not out of like a lack of care, but maybe you could almost say too much care. Like it's definitely like worn out from like love. Cause like I said, that was like my first, like, you know, big release game that, the hype was around and getting my parents to grab it. Nintendo Power. A kid brought his like first issue to class and like, I was able to borrow it and my dad was able to get the subscription. And I mean, I just read that like, you know, cover to cover and, you know, Super Mario Brothers 2 was just like my jam. I am not sure what I was more excited for back then, Mario 2 or Mario 3.
Yeah, like, see, that era of hype bypassed me entirely because I kind of came to the NES quite late. But yeah. Thinking about it in retrospect, do you think like, oh, Mario 2, obviously Mario 3 is the bigger and better one immediately because it's the sequel, but it's not that simple. So that's just such an interesting instance from Nintendo, I think.
Yeah, if anything, like, you know, looking back, I probably favor Super Mario Brothers 2 more than Super Mario Brothers 3 now, in part because of how different it is. Mm-hmm. Because, like, at the time, Nintendo hadn't gotten into quite the rut they would get into in the, say, 2000s, the 2010s, where it's like, you know, Bowser kidnaps Peach, Mario goes through 8 worlds to rescue, fighting familiar foes, getting old power-ups and some new power-ups, and, you know, it became, like, it's just made stuff like Super Mario Brothers 2 and Super Mario Land and Super Mario Land 2 just stand out all the more to me and just, you know, put them on their own pedestals.
Something I still like to think about is a little bit of an inception going on where Mario, in the instruction booklet, as I recall, he and his friends go on a picnic and after he dreams that, you know, oh my God, Subcon is under attack. And then you finish the game and you wake up from the dream. So what's the dream? What's the reality? Was any of Mario 2 real? It had to have been.
That always threw me because, yeah, Mario dreams about, like, you know, the voices coming from the door and the cave and all that stuff. And then he goes it like they go on a picnic and then they discover the world of dreams and stuff and they go into it. And then at the end, Mario wakes up and it's like, so like, yeah, it was like, was any of that real?
And he would say, OK, well, maybe not. But hey, we got Shy Guys, we got Ninjas, and we sure as hell got Birdo. So
speaking of Shy Guys, can I share a little anecdote from way back when?
Of course.
I've written about this on my website, poisonmushroom.org, before, but basically, like, one of my earliest memories of Super Mario Brothers 2 was a little tiny screenshot on a poster that would come with, like, you know, games and the consoles and that kind of stuff. I remember it was even displayed, like, on a window of a video rental store when, like, I was first getting into this stuff. And it was basically Mario, like, I'm trying to remember exactly what he... I think he might have been throwing a vegetable, or maybe he was throwing the Shy Guy itself. Either way, that Shy Guy was having a very bad day. back then, like, horror movies were, like, so much not my thing. They were much more my cousin's thing. So I had, like, some very peripheral tertiary knowledge. And I don't know if I thought, like, all horror movies took place in dreams, but I knew that at least, like, you know, one did.
Yeah.
Nightmare on Elm Street. And somehow, like, of course, you know, you've got the two biggest, like, you know, horror icons of all time. You got Freddy Krueger from Nightmare on Elm Street and Jason Voorhees from Friday the 13th.
Right.
I don't know if I had that much distinction between the two. Somehow I thought basically what ended up happening was I thought Jason was the dream guy and that Mario was basically kicking his ass on the poster. Because the Shy Guy mask kind of looks like the Jason hockey mask in a way. I actually had a cosplay that played off of that one year.
You did. It was actually quite successful, as I recall.
Yeah. It was like basically a Jason Voorhees Shy Guy.
And, I mean, when you think about it, that did officially come to pass. And was it Mario Land 2 where you had the Halloween Town or whatever and little Jason Voorhees guys? Yeah, yeah. Pumpkins. What a great
Yeah, it was like name. These little hockey masks, like with eyes like peeking out, and like they just had feet, and there was like a knife sticking in them, like from one of the Friday the 13th movies. I think it was part 5. I don't know. I'm not, you know, I'm a little more into it these days, but I'm not like, you know, super well versed. But
yeah,
yeah, it was like, I think it was this, whatever they based it on. Like they did that for the title screen of the NES Friday the 13th as well.
Yeah, the knife kind of goes through the eye hole, and there's like a shink, and it's all lights up, exactly. And it's all cool and shit. Yeah, yeah. And of course, Mario 2 had Wart. And the thing is also like there's a lot that you can associate with Dreams with Mario 2. So maybe some other stuff if you stretch it a little bit further. But then you think, well, okay, what do frogs have to do with Dreams? Wart. Probably nothing. Although, well. That does kind of tie into another game that we will be talking about in a moment, doesn't it?
Yeah, I believe so.
But before we do that, if you don't have anything else you wanted to say about Mario 2, any observations, any extra cool tidbits or facts or anecdotes?
Like as it pertains to the dream thing, or because I mean, I could go on like, you know, for days about Mario 2. You know,
Yeah, I know that. No, just the dream. Just the dreaminess of it all. Like, did the ending impress you? The Mario animation?
I don't think we had a Super Mario Brothers cartoon just yet. So at the time, yeah, like, you know, seeing something like that did kind of blow me away.
Yeah,
even
Mario.
Even if it was just a simple looping animation.
Yeah, it was pretty impressive for the NES, though, at the time, that's for sure. It's not a bad-looking game.
Yeah, I honestly think it looks better than Super Mario Brothers 3 in some respects.
Yeah, I don't think you're wrong. I think Mario's sprite, for one thing, it looks a lot better. And the fact that Mario and Luigi look different, and that's where Luigi got his physical personality, argumentatively,
yep.
if that's a word. Move on to a game that came out a year later-ish. That's Little Nemo, the Dream Master by Capcom for the NES. Now, this came out just as Capcom was hitting its stride, so that would have been around the DuckTales / Mega Man 3 era of its legacy. Did anything else come out around like 89, off 90, off the top of your head that's worth shouting out around this era? When did Bionic Commando come out, for example?
Woo! Bionic Commando, that was late 1988, right around maybe just after Super Mario Brothers 2, as I recall.
Wow, so the NES, like, was just really hitting a stride. It's almost as if there's a dude out there who has a whole series about this on YouTube. I don't know, you can look him up or something.
Yeah, I hear he works really hard at it.
It's, Barami Parish?
But,
Paramigerish, yeah, that's it. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, my recollection with, like, Bionic Commando, that was, I believe, in the second issue of Nintendo Power, which was, like, the back half of 1988. DuckTales, yeah, that came out the next year, 89. I forget when Rescue Rangers came out.
It was around, like, that time. But either way, I don't think any of those games had anything to do with Dreams, sadly enough. But, it's worth pointing out Little Nemo the Dream Master because, of course, that was based on Dream. I did not play this game, actually, and I was surprised to find out you did not either. I thought you'd be carrying me on this one.
Yeah, no, it's one I've always kind of wanted to check out, but it just never quite happened. And, you know, here's the funny thing. It's never been re-released, and there's a reason for that because it's actually based on a licensed property like DuckTales and Rescue Rangers that we mentioned. I did not know that at the time. This was the first I ever heard of Little Nemo and then found that out. And it's like, oh, okay. I guess that explains why they're not doing more with it. But my biggest encounter with it that I remember besides reading about it in Nintendo Power, like I do, it was when I went to an EB game or I'm sorry, it wasn't an EB Games. It was an electronics boutique.
Oh, pardon me. So,
yeah, I was with my parents. Like, you know, we were out of town. We were in one of the big cities back there, and with the big malls and places I lived didn't have the game stores quite like that. Like, if I was lucky, I could get my local rental place to order a copy of Ninja Turtles for me. Yeah. So I could buy it. But, yeah, and I just remember it being on some sort of strange monitor. It wasn't like a flat screen. I don't think it was a flat screen, but it had kind of a overlay on it. It was almost like a table, but I think it was like slanted. I don't know. It's just such a weird thing. I only remember seeing it the one time and never again. But I watched the gameplay on a loop, and, you know, it looked pretty neat, but I just never quite got around to it.
Back when it tracked me, that's the right thing, I suppose. The the slanted monitor thing, by your description, I am confident that someone will give you the answer to what that was. And I think you told me the story before, and you were saying how it was very boutique-y of the this electronics store to have this piece of furniture. You go to an EB Games now, and it's just, well, even the ones in Canada are like mostly Funko Pop at this point.
Yeah.
But they're all trying. They're all trying their best out there. But Little Nemo the Dream Master, yes, that is based on, like, at the core, yes, it is a newspaper comic that ran from 1905 to 1927. Now, that's obviously public domain by now, but I think where the rights issues come into play, there is a Little Nemo. I know there is a Little Nemo remaster out there, or it is coming out, rather.
And, is it a remaster?
Maybe it's a new game. I'm sorry. Maybe it's a new game. But, so this was actually based on a 1989 U.S.-Japanese anime movie adaptation of the Little Nemo comic. That's what the game was based on. And I have not seen this movie, actually.
Me neither.
That would probably be part of the reason for the rights issues. But, yeah, so the reason I remember it at all, even though I didn't play it, is because I would watch Video Power, like reruns, incessantly, and it was, since everything was in syndication, everything was just kind of run out of order and haphazardly, so I ended up seeing a lot of Little Nemo again and again and over, and that just, he kept coming back like the cat in the rhyme, and I was like, oh, that looks pretty cool, I should try that sometime. I never did.
Yeah, I think I saw it on Video Power as well. I did not know that it was based on a movie, which, you know, that probably speaks to how well that movie was marketed at the time.
Yeah.
Because I did not find out about that until years and years later. Possibly not until, like, you know, post-internet. And, you know, at the same time, this is always the thing that kind of gets me with some of these licensed games. Mm-hmm. Something like that where it's that obscure and it's, like, not in the cultural zeitgeist. How much would it really cost to renew the rights for that?
Yeah, like I said, there is the, and I feel bad because I know they follow me on Blue Sky, there is the Nemo remaster coming out, or remake rather, or new game. But I think they had to deal with the rights issues as well before they could make it.
I mean, undoubtedly, I imagine there's rights issues, but for a company like Capcom, it's like, you know, you look back at some of the old stuff, like, you know, they or Konami have released, and it's just, you know, like, okay, there are people who are interested in Bucky O'Hare, and it's like, okay, Konami, like, you know, there's not a lot going on with this. Like, you don't have to develop a new game. It's like, you know, how much does it really cost that you can't, you know, do something with this?
Captain Bucky O'Hare, he goes where no ordinary rabbit would dare. I never watched it, but yeah, I remember the, and yeah, you're right. Like, you know, the kids could do with seeing Bucky O'Hare again. Why the hell not? Little Nemo.
They did get some new action figures a few years ago. I mean, if that, like, startup could afford the rights.
Oh, there you go. So that's the lesson of this episode. More Bucky O'Hare.
Yeah, not a bad lesson from what I hear. I believe it was created by Larry Hama of G.I. Joe fame.
Oh, really?
If I remember correctly.
Huh. So have you ever played any of the Land of Illusion games or / Illusion games, like the Mickey Mouse, you know, the ones I'm referring to, on, because they've kind of expanded. They've been on the Master System. They've been on the Game Gear, you know, like Castle of Illusion, Land of Illusion. This is the World of Illusion.
As I recall, Castle of Illusion and World of Illusion are both on the Sega Genesis Mini that we've got. So
there you go.
Yeah, I've played them. There was also a 3D remake of the first one that I think I've got for something somewhere. I can't remember if it was Xbox or Steam, but I managed to snag it at some point.
Well, these games take place, like, as the name suggests, in Lands of Illusion. And with Disney, you're kind of playing fast and loose with the definition anyway, because you're already talking about a mouse and a duck with no pants running around. So how do you get more dreamlike than that? The main reason I wanted to bring it up is because I have a really interesting memory tied to it. It's the first quote-unquote foreign game I played. A Korean friend of mine had a copy from Japan. He let me play it on the Game Gear for 5 minutes before class one day. And I was just like, wow, Game Gear looks really pretty. I didn't want to admit it because I was a Nintendo kid, but yeah.
I hear you.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, you just put a strange thought into my head.
You just activated my trap card, sure.
So you're talking about, like, you know, the shirtless mouse and the pantsless duck and how dreamlike that is and stuff.
Yeah.
And now I'm wondering, if Mickey and Donald did a fusion dance, would they be wearing a shirt and pants, or would they be wearing neither?
Either way, being in front of God, so it doesn't matter. If their clothing would not affect the fact that they should not be an atrocity. Clothes or naked is still an atrocity. Gorge. Here's another big one I think we're both interested in talking about, and it's a no-brainer. Link's Awakening for the Game Boy, 1993. This was... I bought this game from a friend of mine in high school, and I just have a really cool memory of sitting in a bus station that I would, you know, just kind of sit in to go home and playing while waiting for the bus. And this, of course, is a game that is adorable, it's sweet, and it really manages to capture the eerie backdrop of a dream. And I think one of the best ways it does that is, you know, you kind of wake up, your Link wakes up on the shore of Colton Island. It's a weird place where there's a egg on the mountain for some reason. But he just kind of, like, other than realizing, oh, this chick kind of looks like Zelda, he just takes everything in stride. And until you reach the shrine, which is... I can't remember when you visit the shrine in Link's Awakening, but it's not too far into the game. And that's when things kind of get serious, because you see that mural that explains in a vague way the wind fish. And human monsters see in sky a scene on the lid of a sleeper's eye. And that's when you realize something might be kind of wrong here. What do you think?
My understanding is it was inspired a lot by Twin Peaks. I don't know how much of that is dream-focused, but...
I have admitted on Acts of Blood God several times that I have not watched, like, any Twin Peaks, even though it would be exactly my shit. And so this is really something I gotta get to.
I think the big tip-off on the dream thing with me was some of the cameo appearances in it.
There's a lot of those, isn't there? They just kind of, like, throw in... I love Mr. Wright from SimCity is probably my favorite.
Yeah, and then you've got Kirby from Dreamland, and you've got Mamu, a.k.a. Wart, from Subcon from Mario 2, as we discussed.
There you go.
Some other Mario enemies as well. You know, my fan theory has always been that, like, after being dethroned, that Wart managed to escape through the, like, dreamscape to Koholint to basically kind of recover or lay low or something until, like, he could plot his next move.
It's actually a more creative idea than what the Mario Galaxy movie did, to be honest with you. I think it's neat. I think that's a cool idea. I mean,
thank you.
Yeah, you're right. Never, you know, I don't think I realized it, that, yes, those are all dream characters. Wart is from a dream. I think the Shy Guys are there in some capacity, too, aren't they?
I'm not sure. I remember there was the Chain Chomp. There was the Goombas. I'm blanking on whoever else. Like I said, there was like the Kirby. I forget who all else there was in that regard. Well, there were dream versions of, like, you know, Ganon and the bosses from A Link to the Past.
Yeah, the nightmares. I think despite the fact that this game is honestly one of the saddest Zelda games ever made, and it has some really, it has like a really impactful ending, if for a moment I'll speak of it in a minute, it's also really funny. Like you mentioned, we were talking about these characters, right? And I completely forgot that Dr. Wright was writing to quote unquote Christine, who was, you know, depicted as Peach in the photo.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he finds out, or you find out, he's actually been writing to a goat the whole time. And the goat keeps eating the letters. And that's why Wright's like, oh no, she hates me. She loves me not. She's not responding to my letters anymore. It's like, oh, I keep eating them. I can't get them. I'm in a real bind. And it was a very silly but funny game. I think that's Takahashi Tezuka worked on that one, if I'm not mistaken. Like, he was the director. I can't remember if he was the fan of Twin Peaks, but it's definitely a different Zelda game, but in a really good way. And go on.
Oh, you brought up Peach Toadstool, and for that matter, I believe what was her name?
Malin and Talon. Malin. Marin. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, Talon was based, or at least looked kind of like Mario, didn't he?
Yes.
Yeah, and both of those from Mario 2, a dream game. Hey, connections.
Hey, yeah, there you go. And I just thought of this, I could be wrong. Isn't Birdo's preferred name Christine, or wasn't she called Christine elsewhere? And that's like the name that they used on the Peach photo?
I don't think so. In the U.S. manual, she prefers to be known as Birdetta.
Right.
And I believe it was Catherine for...
Catherine, that's it. I was thinking a C word, a C name.
Yeah.
A C word, that's very inappropriate. Sorry, Birdo, you don't deserve that.
No. Funny thing about Link's Awakening, I think that was the first Game Boy game I ever owned.
Really?
Yeah, my parents were not, like, they were totally against me, like, owning a Game Boy. They said it would ruin my eyes. Shows what they know. My eyes got ruined anyway.
Your eyes are so much better than mine, but yeah, go on.
But yeah, so the Super Game Boy was like a saving grace for me.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, I could play all these games that I'd been missing out on that my parents just did not understand why I would want to play them. Like when, I've got like NES and Super NES, and it's like, I mean, these were like missing entire, like, you know, chapters and like lore and characters and just stories,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, it might be like saying that.
Like, you know, why do you need Back to the Future Part 2? We've already got Back to the Future Part 1 and Part 3, you know? It's, you know.
Oh, yeah. Like, to you other kids all across the land, take it from me, parents just don't understand.
But yeah, I remember Zelda. I believe that was the first one that I ever got. And eventually I, like, you know, got my hands on Metroid 2 and some of the Mega Man games and Donkey Kong, of course, the legendary, which is funny. I didn't get that one because, like, that was the one that was, like, originally the selling point of it. But I came back around. I think Zelda took priority on that one.
So the thing that kind of makes Zelda Link's Awakening a little bit tragic to me is the fact that there's nothing forcing Link from collecting the wind fish instruments and waking it up. The fish is dreaming, and yes, it's kind of in a nightmare. It is in the thrall of the nightmare, but Link could still theoretically be happy where he is with Marin, and she says as much, you know, just kind of suggested, like, but he wakes up the windfish anyway, and it's not because I don't think he doesn't want to stay. It's because he knows, being Link, he has responsibilities out there in the real world. And it's a kind of sad, solemn little bit of character development for a little guy.
Yeah, which is kind of funny, like, the way that works out. Because, yeah, the reason he was on that boat in the first place was he was set out to basically, I guess, become, like, you know, get better training, become a better warrior, that kind of thing, so he could better defend Hyrule.
Yeah.
I don't know that we ever get to see him do that again, although there's like rumors regarding A Link Between Worlds so many years later.
Right.
Like that, like, you know, he's the old man, but I can't remember if a timeline thing had shown it or if they've retconned it or how that worked out. But there's talk. You remember how similar that Oracle of Ages and Oracle of Seasons are to Link's Awakening, especially in the graphics?
Yes.
I believe the talk was, I don't remember if that's ever been confirmed or retconned or I don't know. The whole thing's topsy-turvy to me at this point. But that, like, though, that was the mission he ended up going on, and Link's Awakening was him going back to Hyrule.
Ah, interesting.
So.
Oh boy, Zelda timeline. Not confusing in the least.
As far as the Windfish Awakening, though, it's one of those things where it's like, okay, Mario 2, like, I never believed it was just a dream. Like, believe that, like, Wart and Subcon and all that stuff actually exist, just maybe, like, you know, a different plane of existence. In the case of Link's Awakening, I feel like maybe, like, does the Windfish, like, would you consider it, like, a god of sorts?
Yeah, I would consider it, like, a god or demigod, a force of nature, even.
Yeah, and it's like, okay, so maybe its dream is manifested into, like, reality, and that's why Link is there?
Yeah.
So it's not, like, actually a dream in the normal sense, but, like, you know, it's like, okay, when gods dream, like, you know, what is the result? And maybe this is, like, an answer there, like, you know, maybe we're all, like, in a god's dream.
Oh, absolutely. That is very, that would very much be the kind of thing that someone who likes Twin Peaks would write into a video game. So there's no surprise there. But yeah, I mean, my grandfather used to say that kind of thing all the time. What are we dreaming? What's reality? My dad said, yeah, that's the kind of thing that you would say after being in the death camps, to be honest with you. But moving right along.
Well, this just got dark.
Like Link's Awakening. Nights into Dreams, a.k.a. the Nakaverse, which I wrote here, apparently. This is another game that I assume that you had played that I did not really play very much. It is a 3D action game about saving a dream world called Nightopia from a monster called Wise Man. This is designed by Naoto Oshima and programmed by the one and only Yuji Naka. And they studied the works of Freud and Jung for this game, as well as other psychoanalysts, and did, you know, put more actual research about dreams and REM sleep. And they kind of smashed that together with Cirque du Soleil and created kind of a, I just to this day, I associate the look with Yuji Naka for better and worse. Never dug the Pierrot look, but he really does, apparently.
I mean, I would think the look would be attributed more to Oshima. He was the designer, as I recall, so.
Okay, well, you might be right.
It says right
that.
There, designed. Yeah, Naka, yeah. Like, you know, is handling the code.
He sure was. And you want to talk about nightmares? Well, you can say that this, the Sonic Extreme crew that wanted that code so that they could get Sonic Extreme done. And yeah, Naka said, no, there's a nightmare for you.
Yeah. I mean, one of the dudes on that nearly died, so...
That's a Sonic X story, like... Yeah, like, I know it's kind of silly and fun to dunk on Naka right now, because, well, he's arrested, and I don't know if he's in jail, but he's definitely in trouble. But it is really a bit of a shame that for people who worked with him, Naka was a very difficult person to get along with, and...
To say the least.
And at the same time, he's... bloody brilliant, like brilliant programmer, no doubt about that. But when you put him side by side with like Iwata, and remembering how much Iwata contributed, because he didn't have that ego, he just wanted to make games better, and he wanted to make sure people knew how to make better games. Like, I really wish Naka had been a bit more like that, but you can't really change a person's personality, I guess.
As far as Nights, I have not played too very much of it. I've played demos. Let's see. I had a Sega Saturn demo CD of Christmas Nights that I just realized I am probably never getting back. Oh, but right. I actually have the game on Xbox and possibly on Steam. Just haven't had a chance to play it. It's something that I kind of got with the hopes of doing it on stream. So maybe that's something we can bump in at some point. My biggest exposure to it, besides playing it at demos and stuff, was Archie Comics did two miniseries based on it.
Oh, right.
And my understanding is they were not very accurate, so surprise, surprise.
Was this another instance where they had they had no knowledge of the games and they didn't really even have the games, and they just said, well, good luck with that and make a comic with it?
I'm going to say yes and no, and also that I have not read enough about the development of those comics to really say for sure. But it would make sense on the first one, but then the second miniseries probably came out later enough that they should have been able to figure something out, but I guess not.
Who wrote that one? Do you remember who wrote it?
Unfortunately, I do not. I do not think it was He Who Shall Not Be Named, but Patrick Spazianti did the covers at the very least. I can't remember if he drew any of the issues.
Right, right.
It's definitely one of those long obscure things, like maybe just slightly more remembered than the Adventures of Bayou Billy comic that Archie made.
I feel like I remember the Captain N episode more than I remember anything else about that game, especially since that was the episode that had no background at one instance, as I recall, just like Kevin standing in a blank peach void. It was really scary.
Yeah, that was like a screw up on someone's part, and they re-releases and whatnot have fixed it, and people are going back looking for the original, which I think has been found and maybe restored or whatever. I'm not sure. I haven't kept too close a track on that, but I've heard stuff about it. So yeah, the first airing of it was messed up
back in the days when you had to mail cells to each other via FedEx. So if something like that happened, it's we're going to air right now. So good luck to all of us.
Yeah. Regarding Knights, I know it got a sequel on the Wii, which, for all the people clamoring for a sequel, I've heard it. I don't think it sold very well, and from what I've heard, maybe it wasn't very good either, so.
Yeah.
That probably doesn't help. But it's funny to see how just the whole Dream thing, Sonic and the various developers have really kind of stuck with that over the years.
Yeah, they've always been very big into, dreams, as it were.
Yeah. Sonic Shuffle was in a dream, I believe. And more recently, the developers who do the mobile stuff, they did Sonic Dream Team, which is another kind of neat looking 3D platformer, like a Dreamscape thing. I've heard it's really good. It almost makes me want to get Apple Arcade and play it, but I'm not going to jump on my phone.
It's stuck on arcade. That's right. The game with Lanolin, the sheep?
I believe the, let's just call her a Rosalina equivalent for the setting, for lack of a better term. I forget what her name is offhand. Lanolin is a different sheep from the IDW comics.
And also Garfield Revenge.
Dun, 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 dun. Yep.
If I'm not mistaken. Yeah.
You're correct. Bo and Lanolin, sheep from U.S. Acres. Or nice. Orson's Farm if you're outside the United States.
Yeah, I remember when he came up here and he saw Orson's Farm for the first time, instead of U.S. Acres, and he freaked out.
Yeah, what? A little bit.
That was really funny.
What? Do we want to mention the other Naka Oshima joint that had kind of a dream thing going on, or is that coming up later?
Oh, we can give that a quick mention. It's not really retro at this point, but it sure is something, and that is Balan Wonderworld, which, when I look at Balan these days, I'm like, he just reminds me of I don't know what, a smiling friend character from an episode about rejected game mascots, another episode about rejected game mascots. He's just got a weird smile. It's just so malicious.
It reminds me of the Amazing Digital Circus as viewed through Sonic Team 1's.
Maybe that's what I'm thinking of. Maybe I'm not thinking of smiling friends.
I made a graphic once that was Balan versus Kane, in a death battle.
Oh, okay, yeah, that tracks. I can absolutely see Balan being like, hey, kids, you're going to go into a fun adventure where we're going to burn you alive.
Are you sure that's not Kane?
I don't know. Balan that one's a weird looking character, and it's a weird game. I never played it, so I'm not going to dunk on it too much. I just remember Foxbox being a meme that, like, when I saw what it was, like, literal fox to box transformation, I pretty much died inside in the best possible way. I can't explain it. Speaking of dreams.
Yeah, there was like a Just Bad Games episode from ReRes on that. That's most of my exposure to it. That and playing the demo, of course.
Oh, right, right. Oh, God.
I don't know. I feel kind of bad about it because, I don't know, I feel like there was something there and it just did not land. It so did not land.
Yeah, it's A for effort, E for everything else, I guess.
That's like a level of not landing that Beck from Mighty No. 9 looks at and is just like, damn, son.
Ouch, that's pretty bad.
Yeah.
I want to move along to the PlayStation because there's a game here that I think is really interesting, and I only just recently discovered about it while researching this episode, and that is LSD, the Dream Emulator for the PlayStation, 1998. Now, dream sequences, as we've been talking about, are very common in games, but they're always like a lot more coherent than an actual dream is, because it kind of has to be if you're going to play a level, that you can't just have people randomly clipping through the floor. That's just called bad game design. But Asmisk, do you remember Asmisk? The company Asmisk, it had the little pink dinosaur?
Yes. If I can just pull back the curtain a little bit here, I'm looking at the notes. And like in the first part, you mentioned LSD Dream Emulator from Asmisk. And my first thought was to say, boomer! And then the next line, well, do you want to carry that?
Yeah, I said in the next line, do you remember the pink dino mascot, boomer?
Yes.
How does he still come to mind when I can't remember any of these games, any of Asmisk's games off by heart, but I just remember seeing their logo and that dinosaur, whose Japanese name, pardon me, is Boomer-kun, which is obviously ten times better than just Boomer. But he's a real kind of goofy-looking, cool mascot. I think he's a neat design. No wonder I still remember who he is.
Yeah, Asmisk needs to bring back Boomer, and maybe bring back Asmisk, too.
I mean, Asmisk is still around.
Oh, are they?
They are, believe it or not. They're a media company, a multimedia company. And as it turns out, LSD was a game by a multimedia artist named Usamu Sato, who was also a game developer and made the Dream Emulator for the PlayStation as kind of an interactive art project. And interestingly, they believed that the PlayStation was the place for this project because, by comparison, the Saturn and Nintendo systems, Nintendo 64, seemed like toys. And that's, I didn't really know that kind of attitude was prevalent in the East as well as the West at the time, but it's just interesting that it was. But when you look at this game, quote unquote, basically it's based on a dream diary by an Asmisk employee. They kept it for a decade. And it's just goofy, surreal stuff that happens as you walk to a place and things change and warp, and, you know, as you go through these areas, you are given the opportunity to form like kind of a truncated memory of them. It's hard to explain. It's really something you have to, quote unquote, play or watch for yourself. But what's interesting about it is it makes less sense the longer it goes on, which is okay. So what I said earlier was like how like most games are when they have dream sequences, those dreams have to be coherent enough to make a level out of. Whereas in this case, it was just like, whatever. what the problem there is that I think that maybe this game was initially not so successful because, well, the reason dream surrealism works is because it is within the context of a dream and it makes sense within a dream. I don't know about you, but I've had dreams where like I invent the funniest joke in the world and I'm telling this joke in this dream and everyone's laughing. And I'm like, since I'm a lucid dreamer, I'm like, oh man, when I wake up, I'm going to say this joke. We're going to be rich. I'm going to be the greatest writer who ever lived. And I wake up and I remember the joke and it's something like fart, just the word fart. Something that's like marginally funny, but not necessarily, you know, an actual brilliant kind of, you know, word. And I think to myself, okay, well, that's just the nature of dreams. I guess something that's fantastic in a dream doesn't necessarily mean anything in the real world. And I guess it holds true for a game that's literally about dreaming as well, because it's, I think more people came out for this game in retrospect.
Well, what you're describing, besides like my garbage in, garbage out dreams, reminds me of Homer that time when, like, you know, they're having money problems and everybody's congratulating him on this, like, you know, fantastic invention that'll change the world as we know it. And, you know, just he cannot see what it is. And like, by the time he wakes up, it's like gone. And that's like just like every brilliant idea I've ever had in a dream, it feels like.
Why would you need to see this? You are the inventor of the device in question. Yeah,
yes, exactly. So was this game released outside of Japan?
No, it wasn't. Okay. I think there was like hope to do so, but they probably thought it wouldn't really fly with the Westerners.
Not with a name like that.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of comments about how you should just light one up and, you know, play it, quote unquote. But I really admire the fact that, like, you know, this game tried to embrace the incoherence of dreams rather than the more prophetic, noble part of dreams that you tend to see in video games. So good for you, LSD, the drug that you absolutely cannot take in Japan unless you want to go to jail forever.
Yeah, you know, that's crazy that they use the name there too, for that matter, now that you mention it.
Yeah, that is a little surprising, but I guess because since LSD is probably so unknown in Japan or underused that it's considered so harmless stuff just mentioned in everyday conversation. I don't know. Someone who is more versed in Japanese culture will definitely come to my rescue here.
I guess it's sort of like Grand Theft Auto in that regard. Just kind of, you know.
How so?
Yeah, it's a bad thing, but, you know.
Right.
We can talk about it as a game title or whatever.
Yeah.
I'm surprised they didn't try to be a little cheekier with it. Like, you know, like, say, Lucid Sleep Destination or something.
Yeah, that would really fit, too. Let's briefly mention Mario Party 5, which apparently takes place in a dream entirely. I am not a Mario Party person by extension. I don't think, like, by extension you are not either, because I won't play them with you. So, yeah.
I've played them. I've liked them. Getting together people to play them is a little more difficult.
That's true.
I kind of fell off at some point, but I mean, I like them. But this is one I came into the series really late, like with the last one on the GameCube, I think.
Right.
And it was like spotty, like, well, let's see, they did Mario Party 8 on the Wii, and if nothing else, I like the soda shaking game in that one. But then it's like we did not get new ones for years, and then Mario Party 9 came out, and I checked out that one and 10 and fell off again at some point, but I like what I've played.
Oh, yeah, it seems perfectly fine. It's just a matter of, like, okay, well, you don't really need dreams to bring in, like, as an excuse to bring wacky things into Mario. Like, it's Mario. You want a pirate ship, there's a pirate ship right there. They're flying in the sky, you know.
I mean,
go ahead.
We were just, like, praising Super Mario Brothers 2 for, you know, dreams in Mario, so.
Oh, yeah, I know. I'm just kind of, yeah. When it comes to Mario Party, it's not exactly a franchise I care much about, and I'm sorry that I said that because I look like a bad researcher, but I will make it up to you by saying that once I was, you remember when I did karate and they used to have like birthday parties there for kids sometimes. Mm-hmm. And there was one going on one time when I was leaving my lesson, and they had an N64 as like kind of a thing set up in the corner if you didn't want to do karate, I guess. And this was 2010, 60. Anyway, so they had a N64, they had Mario Party, and they had a completely destroyed controller for reasons that should be obvious. Mm-hmm. And my favorite was they had Conker's Bad Fur Day.
Oh my god, really?
Did I not tell you that? They had Conker's Bad Fur Day in a karate birthday party for like 10-year-olds. It was great. I'm okay, the kids are gonna learn about the Great Mighty Pooh today, aren't they?
But, yeah, the Mario Party games, they do have, like, some neat little, like, you know, story, like, you know, expositions for, you know, why things are different in this game versus another.
Yeah.
Or at least they used to. I don't know if the newer ones do, because, like, you know, now it's, like, best of type stuff. But,
yeah.
There's some, like, neat little moments, too. Like, I just remember one where Bowser's trying to do something, and, like, I think it was the first meeting between Bowser and Daisy, and just like he startles her and she just like smacks him into the horizon Team Rocket style. So
I remember
look,
that.
Look it up on YouTube. That is like definitely an all-timer moment. Just
that's a good way
that,
to
that says Daisy is not like, you know, your typical Mario princess.
Anyway, let's move on to a game that I think that I only know about. David, you've never heard of Yume Nikki, have you?
I am not sure. It sounds familiar, but at the same time, it's probably like Yume means dream or something, doesn't it?
Yeah, basically.
Like, I think like Yume something. I'm blanking. Doki Doki Panic, like, you know, Dream Factory Doki Doki Panic,
right?
For Mario 2, and I don't know. Nikki just seems to come up a lot in games, so I probably haven't heard of it, and I'm just conflating it with like other stuff.
Yeah, basically, Yume Nikki came out. I find an extremely interesting part of game history as someone who grew up with a different generation of quote unquote free games versus the millennials that came after me. To me, when I thought of a free indie game, I thought of Cave Story. I thought of Star Control 2 / Urquan Masters. But things got a lot more accessible when stuff kind of. When Java was a thing, when games became, you know, easy to download, easy to make. Yume Nikki from 2003 is an RPG maker game that is one of the most inspirational games for many RPGs to date. It is developed by someone who calls themselves Kikiyama. They're kind of mysterious. They're not much is known about them. They're a bit of a recluse. They're floating around out there, though. They're fine. They're chilling. They're living their best life. But the game Yume Nikki is about a girl named Madotsuki who can't or won't leave her apartment during the game's quote-unquote waking hours. But when she writes in her dream diary, she enters a surreal and pretty much incomprehensible world. And there's no combat here. The world is as opaque as a brick wall. It's one of those games, like, really from the – that are – ironically old school in the way that our games were old school and that they encouraged people to get together and talk and say, hey, what is up with this crazy ass game? What am I doing? Whether it's over in a message board or in the playground, same thing. And you win the game by navigating it successfully and finding the 24 effects. And when you win the game, well, it's not really much of a win. I'll just say that. It's a spoiler to say much else. So Yume Nikki's influence, like I said, inspired millennial gamers, many of whom, like, for example, a good friend of mine, Katie McCarthy, who I used to work with at US Gamer, it was a major inspiration for her because she said she played it when she had no, you know, she was young. She couldn't really afford games. Well, here's this free RPG Maker game that everyone's talking about. This was a game that you could probably tell by looking at it, but it inspired Undertale. It inspired, like, Amori, inspired Doki Doki Literature Club. These are all very important, very big games in the RPG space, the / visual novel space, / adventure game space. And actually, I want to give its soundtrack its own shout out because it's so haunting and eerie that to this day, kids on TikTok use it for like their creepypasta stuff. And I don't even know if they know it, but they're doing it.
I'm just kind of wondering, like, what would happen if somebody swapped Madosuke and Light Yagami's notebooks on them without them realizing?
Oh, dear. I don't know what the Yume Nikki Death Note would look like. It would be terrible. It'd be the end of the world, basically. I mean, Light Yagami is a monster, but at least he had, you know, his desire was for order of the worst kind. whereas Yui Nikki is about chaos of the most devastating kind. Huh. Well, it'd be a crossover event for the ages, that's for sure. Coming to Gashapon next year.
I was going to say, maybe somebody will take it up as a challenge and we'll get something as good as the Columbo meets Frasier.
Columbo meets Frasier is such a masterclass in crossover literature. If you listener, if you don't know what we're talking about, look up Frasier meets Columbo. It's a comic. It's brilliant. It's everything you want out of a comic. But moving along, shout out to Mario and Luigi Dream Team. I played this. You did not, if I'm not mistaken.
I played it.
Did you play it?
Yeah, way back when.
Like, did you like it? I don't remember if you liked it.
I remember finding it enjoyable.
I think that Bowser's Inside Story was better.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, it was very much in the same style of Bowser's Inside Story, where you have, like, the two-screen gimmick where, in this case, you're manipulating Luigi in the real world so you can affect his dreams in the way that, like, you know, you would be running around Bowser's gut. Yeah, you still had, like, a lot of fun stuff going on here, for example. Like, you had the tiny Luigis. I'd forgotten about the tiny Luigis. Luigiinos? Luigiinunos? I forget what they were called. Luigiinos?
Yeah.
And I always just like messing around for the sleeper's dreams. I'm pretty sure there was more than one comic slash parody at the time that would had like the old, you know, thing hand in the container of warm water joke going on, much to the detriment of the person who was committing the prank usually.
Well, one thing that disappointed me about Dream Team, and it's just kind of a common thing with Nintendo and Mario in particular, I guess, is when they have like a theme recur and they just completely ignore what came before.
Yeah.
So like one example would be like, you know, you've got the UFO at the start of Super Mario Galaxy. And for that matter, just the entirety of Super Mario Galaxy and Super Mario Galaxy 2, and not a single peep out of Tatanga, the spaceman.
Yep. I agree.
Or in this case, Mario and Luigi have been to a dream world before. And don't tell me it's not canon in Japan, because they've re-released it and remade it enough times that it is damn sure canon. And, like, I don't think there's a peep of that here either.
I think you're right. And, yeah, I never even thought about Dream Team and Mario 2 having a crossover, but it should. There should be a crossover going on.
Just some kind of linking element. I'm not saying they have to, like, make a Mario 2 RPG, but I don't know, just something to kind of, you know, solidify it somehow.
No, I agree with you. There's still some funny humor in here. Like, Mario and Luigi games are, like, consistently hilarious.
Did you ever check out Brothership?
I did not. I just did not have the time. But looking back at Dream Team, I love some of the puns they had. Like, Pillow Castle, but it's like P-I apostrophe L-L-O. Dr. Snoozemore is a good one. I like the Z Keeper with Z being Z-E-E because, like, the localization wouldn't work otherwise. It's like, what the hell is a Z Keeper? But, yeah, Z Keeper is pretty funny. You know, of course, Beekeeper. So, yeah, Mario and Luigi is great for that kind of stuff. And I know Brothership apparently wasn't great, but I hope they try again. I really, really do.
I hope it was at least funny.
I hear it was. I mean, some people don't like the punny humor, so they didn't like it then either, but they're wrong. They're wrong. Those are good puns. Those are quality puns. Mario games good do good quality puns.
I like a good pun. I also like a bad pun.
Yes, you do. So that's it for games that have, like, that are based in dream sequences. And as it turns out, those are most games that have dream sequences. They are usually based, like, the whole thing is just based around dream half the time. But not all the time. Sometimes it's just, you know, a little bit, a smear of a dream. A little bit of a dream as a treat within the grander scheme of an adventure. And I just want to mention a couple of quick ones here because it is getting late and I am getting sleepy.
I do have one I'd like to chime in when you're ready for it.
Of course. But first, I want to talk about Final Fantasy XIV 1.0, which was infamously the game that was so borked up, so screwed up, so awful that it nearly ruined Square Enix. They had to literally throw a meteor onto Final Fantasy XIV, start again. But that didn't really happen, like, overnight. There was the apocalypse of Final Fantasy XIV was actually implemented into the story and the gameplay, which was fascinating. I think it's still one of the most fascinating examples of that being of a game like being turned off and restarted. Like it's really cool if you ever want to look into the history and the mechanics and everything, the rest of it. But one of the things that new director Naoki Yoshida wanted to do to kind of insinuate what was coming and make people uneasy was one way you can log out of Final Fantasy XIV is to go to the inn and go to sleep. And your little person, your warrior of light does a whole animation to like, they go to sleep, they curl up, they go to sleep and, you know, you have the nice little music. I play Imakote, which is a cat person and a cat boy specifically who is very, very cat-like when he curls up on the bed. And it's really cute and funny. But anyway, some players for 1.0, during this, the changeover period, they would go to sleep. But when they would log in again, they would find themselves in the midst of a nightmare where they would see like dead monsters around them, dead bodies. And they would see one of the bad guys from the game. I won't say who, but they're one of the ones who orchestrate the downfall of the moon that basically smashes into the world and resets everything, or rather hatches Bahamut, who resets everything for them. So it was just a really nice, creepy bit of foreshadowing because, you know, it ends very suddenly, like with your death, you wake up, you fall out of bed, and the very peaceful, nice, happy, you know, end music is playing when you wake up, which is a nice juxtaposition.
Okay.
I think that's just a really neat bit of storytelling and not one that you would expect. Like when a game kind of pulls the rug from under me like that, it always makes me a little bit like nervous.
Can I just say that I appreciate that Square Enix came up with the same solution for resetting the world of Final Fantasy XIV as Killer Croc did for taking out Batman and Batman the Animated Series? Almost got him.
It was a big rock.
Throw a big rock at him. Or throw a rock at him.
It was a big rock. Yeah, yeah, no. Although in the case of Final Fantasy XIV, like you said, it hatched Bahamut, who lay waste to much of Eorzea, and et cetera, et cetera. It's a whole thing. But that was just a really interesting amalgamation of Final Fantasy tropes, by the way. You have the meteor, which is falling, but what comes out of it is Bahamut. So you have a Final Fantasy VII trope mixed with just a Final Fantasy trope, which is Bahamut. Anyway.
That's kind of Final Fantasy XIV in a nutshell, from what I understand, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. That's how basically things work in that game. It's all a bunch of references, but some of them are pretty clever. Pretty clever.
Kind of reminds me of the 2012 Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles series, where they just kind of took stuff from like just all over the history of the franchise and put it together into one new, pretty dang good entry.
Yeah, it lasted for a while, too.
Yeah.
So the last thing I'm going to mention is from the esteemed Mother / Earthbound series, which is Magikant. Magikant appears in the first two Mother games. It's a shared world between Nessa's bloodline, which I guess is one way of looking at it. In both games, they serve up the means to defeat Gyges. In the first game, in Earthbound Beginnings / Mother, it is the Eight Melodies, which you get from Queen Mary. And in Earthbound, basically, your reward for getting through Magikant is a huge, huge boost, which is what you need to go up against Gyges, because going up against Gyges is not a matter of sheer power. It never is in these games. There's always some sort of trick. Like in the first game, singing the Eight Melodies would stun Gyges, and it would upset him so badly that he couldn't fight you, and then he would come back in Earthbound, and it was a real freaking mess. But the point is, Magikant is the way to get to these powers. And in the case of both of these games, like the initial area is a very kind of a very fantasy looking world where with like cotton candy clouds and, you know, swirly things and candyish looking areas and these guys who help out Ness and Ninten called the Birdmen. And I like the Earthbound version, though, because you also get to visit the Sea of Eden. And this is the location of the Mani Mani statue, which is the kind of the worldly incarnation of Gygax that is corrupting humanity as the game is going on. And I guess that includes Ness, because he has to take down the Mani Mani statue. And this is a hard fight because this is just him and this stupid statue. And Earthbound has like a rolling HP mechanic. And this is the only time, I think, in the game where it really becomes in like handy. Whereas like if an enemy hits you with a fatal blow, your hit points start counting down quickly, but they don't go to zero immediately. So you have that time to heal yourself before they hit zero. And this becomes a very, very important mechanic in Mother 3 especially, but it's used to pretty good effect here in the Sea of Eden as well. And I want to give the Sea of Eden a shout out as well, because it has like just some of the loveliest, most discordant music I've ever heard in a video game in that particular area, which is supposed to be the center of Ness's mind, the center of his dream, the center of everything that he is. And that's just interesting that they give you a piece of music that kind of sounds like almost angelic, but in a harsh way. It's just such an interesting game, and it's such an interesting use of dreams. Interestingly enough, I think Mother 3, if I'm not mistaken, takes place in a dragon's dream. But, God, it's been a while. I am tired. Talking about dreams has made me so very sleepy. David, do you have any final thoughts about dreams before I fall asleep?
Well, I did want to add one other. I don't know if it counts as a dream or a daydream or just imagination, but...
Of course.
One I've always enjoyed is from... the Japanese version of Mega Man Legends 2, Rockman Dash 2, or rather the demo that they got for it, as opposed to here. And it's got a scenario. It's basically, the demo is called Episode 1, and the full game is Episode 2.
Uh-huh.
And in Episode 1, there's a scenario where, like, Tron is captured Roll, and she's basically makes Mega Man the offer, like, you know, join me or don't.
Yeah.
And Mega Man imagines what it's like, you know, if he joins with Tron. And, like, you know, the two are basically running in this, like, kind of, like, you know, like, pink, like, you know, lens flare-y, like, looking
the dream
dreamscape.
World. Yeah.
Yeah, and, like, they're laughing and, like, you know, enjoying stuff. And then Mega Man's, like, you know, breaks out as, like, Mega Buster. And he just, like, starts opening fire on people you can't see, but you can hear. And eventually he shakes it off, like, no, that's not for me. But that
was
a popular GIF, whatever.
That... I always wondered about that. Like, is that something he actually wants deep down? Or is that just something like he was, as you say, like, no, I don't think I want that.
I mean, he shakes it off. Like, and that's like if you pick the option, like, you know, two joiners. So,
oh, okay. So
I think overall he leans like, you know, like, nah, not, no.
he's like, oh, actually, that'd be kind of messed up, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Wait a minute. But yeah, that's a pretty funny moment, as I recall.
Yeah.
And with that, that is it for this dreamy episode of Retronauts. If you like our blah, 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 yakety schmackety, please visit the Retronauts Patreon at patreon.com/retronauts and support us there. $3 a month gets you episodes a week early and ad-free. $5 a month gets you all of that, plus Discord access, plus 2 whole bonus episodes a month. Oh my god. The Oh My God Nintendo 64 tier gets you all of that, plus the chance to set a topic once every 6 months. And if you are one with a live stream, at $100 a month, you can guest on the show. Restrictions apply. See Patreon for details. David, where can people find you? I think I know where I can find you. You're in the bedroom, and I'm in the dining alcove right now. Where can other people find you?
Oh gosh, where can't they find me? I'm on social media. I usually post or retweet stuff under the MM Network, the Mega Man Network accounts. And let's see. Also, LBDNYTETRAYN. That's my personal account. I don't do as much on there. Let's see. I really need to get the link for the thing that links to all my other links and whatnot. TheMMNetwork.com. That's the Mega Man Network. That's where I post my stories that I don't get paid for, and various other Mega Man stuff. poisonmushroom.org. That's like basically a lot of articles and stuff that's not related to Mega Man. Also, you and I, we stream every couple of weeks on twitch.tv/Nightworks.
Yes.
And we have YouTube archives of that for Mega Man stuff. Nadia and David's Mega Man Mayhem. We just finished doing the Wily Wars this past weekend.
We sure did.
Did the Wily Tower. And you can find that and everything up to that point in the classic series that we've done on the Mega Man Network, one word, YouTube channel. If it's not one word, you're going to get a bunch of Battle Network stuff instead. For Nadia and David Ruin Video Games, which is where we play basically anything else that's not Mega Man, you can go to the Nightworks, NYTEWORKS, YouTube channel, and our archive of stuff is there. We're currently playing Super Mario Brothers Wonder, although last time we took a detour for Star Fox. Mm-hmm. And, you know, hey, maybe we'll play some of these dream games at some point when we wrap up Wonder. Super Mario Brothers 2 sounds pretty good. And like I said, I bought Nights for the purpose of us streaming it, so maybe we could get to that at some point.
I can't wait for the motion sickness. It's going to be great. As for me, my name is Nadia Oxford. I don't know if you knew. Other than here, you can find me mostly at the Axe of the Blood God podcast. We talk about RPGs old and new, Eastern and Western. That is at patreon.com/bloodgodpod. You can also find my book now. I wrote a book. It is called From Pixels to Prose, but Video Games Taught Me About Storytelling. That is available at retrogamebooks.com. It is also on Amazon. So please like, please review, please read, please do all that good stuff.
If you're truly my wife, you will say the thing.
What's the thing?
From the critic.
Buy my book. Buy my book. That one?
That's the one.
All right. I did it. The marriage is saved.
Woohoo!
So, until next time. May your cheek always find the cool side of the pillow. I want to see.